Hi everyone, it's Katie. Before today's episode of America's Most Infamous Crimes, I want to tell you about another show I think you'll love. Crime House and A&E are teaming up on the podcast version of the famous true crime series, The First 48. Each week, Carter Roy takes you inside a landmark homicide case, the interrogations, the dead ends, and the breakthroughs in the critical first 48 hours. Listen to and follow The First 48 every Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
This is Crime House.
Karen Reed was behind bars, but the case against her was already starting to unravel. An anonymous tip had pointed her lawyer towards the house where John O'Keefe's body was found, and the people inside of it. And the deeper he dug, the stranger everything got. Today, I'll walk you through the defense's explosive theory, the suspicious behavior of the people inside 34 Fairview Road, and the investigator whose misconduct may have poisoned this case from the very start. Every crime tells a story about the people involved, the system that tried to stop it, and the nation that couldn't look away. Some cases are so shocking, so deeply woven into who we are that decades later, we're still asking, how did this happen? I'm Katie Ring, and this is America's Most Infamous Crimes. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, I'll take you deep into cases that have a lasting imprint on society and still haunt us today. I want to thank you for being part of the Crime House community. Please rate, review, and follow America's Most Infamous Crimes wherever you get your podcasts. And to get all episodes at once ad-free, subscribe to Crime House Plus on Apple Podcasts. You can also find us on YouTube with full video episodes. Just search America's Most Infamous Crimes and subscribe. Before I get started, please be advised that this episode contains descriptions of death and graphic language, so please listen with care. This is the second of our three-episode series on the death of John O'Keefe and the case against Karen Reed. Today, I'll get into the defense's third-party culprit theory, the deeply suspicious behavior of the witnesses inside of 34 Fairview Road, and the lead investigator whose personal texts blew up the entire case.
Yo, it's Jey Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win.
Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
After John O'Keefe was found dead on the morning of January 29, 2022, the authorities focused their attention on his girlfriend, Karen Reed. In just a few days, Karen was in custody and facing murder charges. But in the lead up to the trial, her lawyer, David Iannetti, got an anonymous tip saying his client was innocent and pointing the finger at the people inside of the house where John's body was found. Iannetti had been digging into the Albert family's connections ever since, and the more he uncovered, the more he believed his client was being set up. But there was still a lot of work to do for Karen to be acquitted, so they brought in more firepower, an LA-based attorney named Alan Jackson. Karen sent him a cold email with the subject line, "Murder of a Boston Cop." Jackson was skeptical at first. He got emails like that all the time, but when he looked at the photos of John's injuries, something didn't sit right. In his opinion, John's injuries did not match a car accident. With Iannetti and Jackson on board, the defense started building their case. They weren't just going to argue that Karen didn't do it. They were going to argue that John was killed inside of the house at 34 Fairview Road, and that the people responsible had framed Karen to protect themselves. The trial began on April 29, 2024, at the Norfolk County Superior Court in Dedham, Massachusetts. The lead prosecutor, Adam Lally, stood up first and delivered his opening statement. He said Karen was angry, she was drunk, and she backed into John at 24 miles per hour and then left him there to die. When it was David Iannetti's turn, he told the jury that his client was being framed. Someone inside of 34 Fairview Road was responsible for John's death, and that the investigation had been engineered from the start to make sure the truth never came out. Karen's team didn't have to prove that outright, though. In a third-party culprit argument, the defense doesn't have to prove who actually killed the victim. Their job is to create enough reasonable doubt to convince a jury that there are other plausible explanations for the victim's death. Most of the time, explanations that investigators never followed through on. So let me remind you of who was inside of that house on the night of January 28th. The homeowners were Brian and Nicole Albert. Brian was a retired Boston police officer who served 30 years on the force. Their adult children, Caitlin and Brian Jr., were both there celebrating Brian Jr.'s birthday party. Nicole's sister, Jen McCabe, and her husband, Matt, were there, and so was Brian Higgins, a federal ATF agent and a close friend of Brian Albert's. The group was rounded out by a few of Brian Jr.'s friends, including Julie Nagel and Sarah Levinson, and Colin Albert, Brian's 17-year-old nephew, who was initially not disclosed as being present. So you had a retired cop, an active federal agent, and a house full of their relatives and close friends. And the defense's argument was that this group, or at least some members of it, had the motive, the means, and the connections to cover up what really happened to John. Here's the theory they presented to the jury. Karen dropped John off at 34 Fairview Road around 12:20 in the morning. He got out, walked up to the house, and went inside. Once he was in there, something went wrong. There was some kind of fight, one that was not meant to end in death, but did. John hit his head on a hard surface, and the injuries were catastrophic. But a house full of cops knew the potential repercussions, even if it wasn't on purpose. The defense didn't pinpoint exactly who hurt him, but they hinted at three possibilities. The first was Brian Higgins, because he wasn't just friends with Brian Albert, he also knew Karen. In fact, Higgins had been texting Karen behind John's back, and they were very flirty. The extremely cringy texts were read out loud at the trial, and the prosecution pointed to them as evidence that Karen was a bad partner who was emotionally cheating on John. But the defense had a different take on it. After the Aruba incident where Karen suspected John of cheating, she'd reached out to Brian Higgins for a confidence boost, but never actually intended to pursue anything. She ghosted Higgins about a week before John died, and that night at the waterfall, she completely ignored him. And maybe Higgins got jealous. After the bars, Higgins texted John to see if he was coming to the party. Karen's lawyers theorized that he wanted John to come over so he could confront him. Let's move on to the second person on their list, Brian Albert's 17-year-old nephew, Colin Albert. Colin had a reputation as a hothead, and despite telling the jury he'd never been in a fight, the defense came with receipts. In the trial, they played a video of him threatening to beat up a group of teenagers. He was also caught on camera in an actual physical altercation. And less than a month after John's death, a photo surfaced showing Colin with scabbed over knuckles on his right hand. When asked about it on the stand, he said that he had fallen on the ice and braced himself with a closed fist. The defense argued that nobody tries to brace themselves knuckles down. And if you've ever fallen, you know that is the last way you would ever catch yourself. But the most curious part about Colin was that his presence at the house was omitted from initial police reports and witness lists. Very interesting. The third person the defense brought up was the homeowner himself, Brian Albert. As an experienced cop, he was a tough, physical guy. And surveillance footage from the waterfall bar earlier that night showed Brian roughhousing with Higgins. The defense suggested that Brian, or someone in his orbit, could have confronted John over something that escalated quickly. And then there was the fourth possible culprit, the dog. The Alberts owned a German Shepherd named Chloe. The defense pointed to the long, deep scratches on John's right arm and argued they didn't look like marks from a car bumper. They looked exactly like scratches or bites from an animal. Maybe scratches or bites from the family's dog of 5 years that was curiously rehomed after John's murder. Maybe Chloe got involved during the altercation trying to protect her owner. The defense's argument was that whoever hurt John didn't necessarily mean to kill him, but when he fell and hit his head, the injuries were too severe to come back from. And this was a house full of people with law enforcement experience, people who understand that intent doesn't matter under the law. If they called 911, someone was going to prison. So instead, they dragged John outside, left him near the flagpole, and waited. The defense suggested that the original plan may have been to blame the snowplow driver, but when Karen showed up the next morning in a panic, already asking whether she could have hit him, they found the perfect scapegoat. a drunk woman who couldn't even remember the drive home. And the foundation of their entire argument was John's autopsy. As I mentioned last time, the medical examiner said the cause of John's death was blunt force trauma to the head and hypothermia, but she ruled that the manner of his death was undetermined, meaning she didn't know how that cause came about. Natural, accident, murder, suicide, or again, undetermined. And when she was asked whether his injuries were consistent with being struck by a vehicle, she said she couldn't find evidence of an impact site on his body. John's injuries were confined to his head, face, and arms. He had skull fractures, brain bleeding, a swollen eye, lacerations on his face and arm, and bruising on the back of his right hand, which many believe to be from the IV. But there was nothing below the neck, not a broken bone, fracture, torn ligament, not even a single bruise on his legs, his torso, or his back. If a 4,000 plus pound SUV hit him at 24 miles per hour, his body should have told a very different story. That disconnect is what brought the defense's theory to life, but it was the behavior of the people inside 34 Fairview that made it stick.
On the morning of April 19, 1775, a ragged band of colonial militiamen took up arms against the powerful British army in an astonishing act of defiance. The shots fired that day in Lexington and Concord would echo around the world, marking the beginning of an extraordinary struggle for liberty, the American Revolution. Hi, I'm Lindsey Graham, the host of the podcast American History Tellers. We take you to the events, times, and people that shaped America and Americans, our values, our struggles, and our dreams. In our latest series, as we approach the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, we'll go beyond the familiar tale of powdered wigs and patriotic glory into the messy, complicated story of what it actually took to build a new nation. As patriot leaders endured brutal defeats and forged unlikely alliances, ordinary citizens would be left to ask themselves what freedom was really worth. Audible subscribers can listen to all episodes of American History Tellers ad-free right now. Join Audible today by downloading the Audible app.
If the people inside of 34 Fairview Road had nothing to hide, they had a strange way of showing it. Let's start with what's maybe the most talked about piece of evidence in this entire case, and the thing that sucked me into the case and led me down a rabbit hole in the first place, Jen McCabe's Google search. At some point on January 29th, Jen typed the words, "Hoss long to die in cold," into her phone, a misspelling of "how long to die in cold." When she took the stand, she said she made that search around 6:23 a.m., right after they found John's body. She testified that Karen was frantic and asked her to look it up. Carrie Roberts, the third woman there that morning, backed up her account. On its face, that's a reasonable explanation, but the defense didn't buy it. They called a digital forensics expert named Richard Green, who analyzed the phone data and testified that the search was actually made at approximately 2:27 in the morning, almost 4 hours before John's body was discovered. If that timestamp is accurate, it means Jen was Googling how long it took for someone to die in the cold while John was still lying out there, alive. And it gets worse. Green also testified that Jen deleted the search after making it. The prosecution pushed back on that hard. They called their own data experts who offered this explanation. At 2:27 a.m., Jen opened a browser tab to search for the song "It's Raining Men." Then around 6:23 a.m., she reused that same tab to type "Hoss long to die in cold." Because the tab was recycled, the phone only logged the original 2:27 a.m. timestamp. So they argued that the search really was made at 6:23. The phone just recorded it wrong. It became a battle of the experts. Both sides had data specialists who directly contradicted each other, and the jury was left to decide who they believed. But even if you accept the prosecution's explanation, the optics weren't exactly good, and the Google search was just the start of Jen's credibility problems. Jen was the prosecution's star witness. She testified that she heard Karen say, "I hit him, I hit him, I hit him," at the scene. But the defense pointed out that Jen never mentioned that statement during her original grand jury testimony. It didn't appear in any of the initial police reports or interviews either. On the day John's body was found, Jen had called back the officer who took her original statement to add that she actually remembered Karen asking if she could have hit him, That's a pretty big accusation, and it happened after the fact, not in the moment. People also found it odd that when the three women discovered John's body on Brian Albert's lawn, Jen never went inside to check on her sister, Nicole. If your friend just turned up dead on your sister's front lawn and your sister wasn't answering her phone, the first thing most people would do is run inside and make sure she's okay. But Jen didn't. Could the butt dial to her sister, Nicole, a butt dial that was answered and lasted around 38 seconds, have something to do with it? She also never went inside to get Brian Albert, a trained first responder and the one person best equipped to help in a situation like this. Brian claimed he slept through all of it. Karen screaming, the EMTs, the police sirens. The defense didn't believe that either. There was also the language Jen used on the 911 call. She referred to John, a man she claimed was one of her closest friends, as a man unresponsive in the snow, my friend's boyfriend, and a guy. That's what I'd call some distancing language. And then Karen's team got into the cover-up angle. Both Brian Albert and Brian Higgins got rid of their cell phones the day before they were served with subpoenas to preserve their phones. The day before he was served, Brian Albert conveniently switched carriers and traded his phone in, which reset his old phone to factory settings, wiping all of his data. Higgins went even further. He took his phone to a military base, separated the SIM card from the phone, and disposed of them in separate garbage bins. But before getting rid of it, he used federal law enforcement resources to download information from the device, which is a violation of federal protocol. When he was asked about that on the stand, the judge stopped him mid-answer and told him to consult with his own lawyer. Then there was a group chat. On February 1st, the day Karen was arrested, Brian Albert texted a group that included his wife, Nicole, his sister-in-law, Jen McCabe, and Jen McCabe's husband, Matt McCabe. He wrote that a news crew was at his brother Chris's pizza shop. Matt McCabe responded, "Ask Chris to ask some questions. Tell them the guy never went into the house." Brian replied, "Exactly." When Alan Jackson cross-examined Jen McCabe and asked her who the guy was, she confirmed it was John O'Keefe. They called the man they claimed was a good friend and whose death they were supposedly grieving, the guy. And the texts only got worse from there. Later in the same thread, Jen wrote that Carrie Roberts was at the house going over timeline and that they had handed the phone to Carrie. Then she texted, "She is telling him everything." Matt replied, "If she pleads out, it will end. If she fights it, it will be an episode." Jen wrote, "I love it." Nicole liked the message. That evening, Jen texted Nicole, "Carrie talked to cops and kept simple." Nicole asked for an update and Jen responded, "We'll get more information tomorrow. Don't want to text about it." This is a group of people who are supposed to be witnesses to a tragedy. Instead, they're monitoring police interviews, coordinating their narratives, and celebrating when a witness keeps things simple. And then Brian Albert sold the house. 10 months after John's body was found on his front lawn, Brian put 34 Fairview Road on the market and sold it for nearly $50,000 under asking price, at a time when the real estate market in the area was red hot. He also rehomed Chloe, the family's German Shepherd of 7 years, the dog the defense believed had scratched John's arm during the altercation. Brian testified that the sale and the rehoming had nothing to do with the case. He said his family had been considering a move for a while. And to be fair, it would be hard to keep living there after John's death. Maybe that's true. But when you add it all up, the destroyed phones, the coordinated texts, the deleted Google search, the sold house, and the rehomed dog, it starts to paint a pretty ugly picture. And of course, we have to talk about the butt dials. At 2:22 in the morning on January 29th, Brian Albert called Brian Higgins. The call lasted 1 second. Albert said he was in an intimate situation with his wife and must have accidentally triggered the call. Higgins then called Brian Albert back. That call lasted 22 seconds. Higgins swore it was also a butt dial. So Brian Albert butt dialed Brian Higgins while having sex with his wife. Higgins butt dialed back. Brian butt answered. They butt stayed on the phone for 22 seconds and then they butt hung up. And don't forget, Jen McCabe supposedly butt dialed John 7 times between 12:29 and 12:51 a.m. and she butt-dialed her sister Nicole at 5:07 a.m., who butt-answered, stayed on the line for 38 seconds, and butt-hung up. There's a much simpler explanation for all of those calls, though, but no one inside the house was willing to offer one, and Karen's lawyers used that to their advantage. Just on the basis of what we've covered so far, I'd say there was some pretty reasonable doubt that Karen Reed killed John O'Keefe. But her defense team had even more incriminating evidence up their sleeves, starting with the behavior of the case's lead investigator, Michael Proctor. When the Canton Police Department recused themselves from the investigation because Brian Albert's brother, Kevin, was one of their officers, the case was handed to the Massachusetts State Police. On paper, that's how it's supposed to work. You bring in someone with no ties to the people involved. So Michael Proctor was assigned as the lead investigator. He'd been in law enforcement for 12 years. He had a wife, a young son, and he was supposed to be the impartial set of eyes this case desperately needed. But it turns out he was the furthest thing from that. After David Iannetti received the anonymous tip about the people inside of 34 Fairview Road, Karen started digging through social media looking for connections between the Albert family and the new investigators, and she found them. A photo from July 2016 showed Proctor's mom at a birthday party with Colin Albert and his father, Chris Albert. Proctor's sister, Courtney, was close with Colin's mom, Julie Albert. Julie had gone to Courtney's wedding, babysat her kids, and had even taken care of Michael Proctor's son just 10 days before John's death. The families weren't just acquaintances, they were friends. Proctor never disclosed any of this. He testified that he didn't really know the Alberts, but his phone and social media said otherwise. And the conflict of interest was just the tip of the iceberg. When the defense got access to Proctor's personal text messages, what they found was jaw-dropping. After seizing Karen's phone as evidence, Proctor had been going through it, not for clues about John's death, but for personal content. He texted a group chat that included fellow officers, no nudes so far. And the text only got worse from there. Proctor called Karen a nutbag, a whack job, and the C word. He mocked her body. He made fun of her for having Crohn's disease and multiple sclerosis, two autoimmune conditions she had been battling since her 20s. And then there was a text he sent to his sister, Courtney. The one that may have done more damage to the prosecution's credibility than any other single piece of evidence in the trial. Proctor said this about Karen. Hopefully, she kills herself. When Alan Jackson forced Proctor to read that text out loud in court, you could feel the air leave the room. This wasn't a detective who'd followed the evidence to a conclusion. This was a man with a personal vendetta against Karen Reed, personal ties to the people she was accusing of framing her, and a level of contempt for her that made it impossible to trust anything he had touched. And he had touched everything. Proctor was the lead on the case from the beginning. He collected the evidence, he conducted the interviews, he determined the direction of the investigation. And within 16 hours of John's death, he decided Karen Reed was guilty. He never once treated anyone else as a suspect. One of Proctor's friends even asked him if the homeowner, Brian Albert, was going to catch any heat. His response, nope, he's a Boston cop too. After Proctor's texts were made public, he was suspended pending an internal investigation. He was formally fired in March of 2025 for unsatisfactory performance and drinking alcohol while on duty. The case against Karen Reed was now inseparable from the man who built it. And that man had just been exposed as someone who wished the defendant was dead. And Proctor wasn't the only officer on the case with problems. His boss, Sergeant Yuri Buchnick, was in the group chat where Proctor joked about searching for nudes. Buchnick didn't reprimand him. In fact, he gave the message a thumbs up. Buchnick also tipped off Brian Higgins, warning him that if any text messages on his phone had been edited, investigators would find out and he'd get in trouble. Even some of the prosecution's seemingly independent witnesses had connections that raised eyebrows. At first, Katie McLaughlin, the Canton firefighter who testified she had heard Karen say, "I hit him," didn't seem to have any affiliation with the Albert family. But during the cross-examination, the defense revealed that she'd gone to high school with Caitlin Albert, Brian's daughter. They'd run track together, they had traveled and partied together, and a photo surfaced of the two of them at a baby shower together in June of 2021, just 8 months before John died. On the stand, McLaughlin denied having a personal relationship with Caitlin. The defense suggested she committed perjury. All of these connections might be able to be explained away by saying this was the kind of place where everybody knew each other, especially when it came to law enforcement and first responders. But the thing is, there were a lot of problems with the investigation beyond the officer's personal conduct. John's body was never photographed in its original position before EMTs moved in, meaning no one on the investigative team knew his exact location at the scene. And when officers went to search that area around 34 Fairview Road, they used leaf blowers to clear the snow, which can understandably displace evidence and contaminate a scene. They collected blood samples in the snow by scooping them up with red Solo cups and stored them in Stop and Shop grocery bags. Evidence wasn't logged properly, reports weren't written, body cameras weren't activated, and some evidence sat in Michael Proctor's personal possession for weeks before it was turned over to the crime lab. The taillight evidence was especially suspicious. The first search team using those leaf blowers to get all the way down to the grass didn't find a single piece of Karen's taillight at the scene. But when a second team came back later that afternoon, they found shards of broken taillight near the flagpole. And Proctor continued finding additional pieces on February 8th, February 11th, and February 18th, almost 3 weeks after John's death. The Canton police chief even claimed he had spotted a piece while driving past the house. And there was a problem with the taillight pieces themselves. The shards found at the scene didn't have any blood or DNA on them. If Karen's taillight shattered because it struck a human being hard enough to kill him, you'd expect to find some trace of that person on the glass, but there wasn't. The prosecution did point to microscopic fragments of red and clear plastic found embedded in John's clothing, but Proctor hadn't turned John's clothes over to the crime scene until 6 weeks after they were recovered, and there was no record of whether the clothing had been stored separately from other evidence, including the taillight fragments from Karen's car. The defense presented their own explanation for the taillight damage. Video footage from the morning of January 29th shows Karen backing her Lexus out of John's driveway in a rush and clipping the right rear taillight against John's car. When she left the house that morning to go looking for him, she was frantic and barely functional. The defense argued that this is what cracked her taillight, not a collision with a human being. And everyone who saw that car that morning described the damage as a crack. The officer who towed the car testified that the piece missing was no bigger than a dollar bill. But by the time it was photographed at the police station, the entire taillight was shattered. Then there was John's phone data. His Apple Health app showed his last activity at 12:32 a.m., 36 steps covering a distance of about 86 feet. The prosecution said those steps were John getting out of Karen's car and being immediately struck, but the defense pointed out that the phone also recorded John climbing stairs 10 minutes earlier at around 12:22 a.m. If Karen really did drop him off and he walked up to the house, those stairs would be consistent with him going inside. That would mean John was in the house for at least 10 minutes before ending up on the lawn. And then there was the plow driver, Brian Lucky Loughran, who had been plowing the streets around 34 Fairview all night. He passed the house for the first time at 2:45 a.m. and didn't see a body. But when he came back for a second pass at 3:30 a.m., he saw a dark SUV parked out in front, but still no body. If the prosecution's timeline was right and Karen hit John shortly after midnight, his body should have been on that lawn for nearly 3 hours by Lucky's first pass. But Lucky didn't see anyone. And wouldn't you know it, Michael Proctor never interviewed Lucky and had conveniently left him off of the witness list. The defense had to track him down themselves. And then there was the footage from the Canton police station where Karen's car had been towed. During the trial, the prosecution played surveillance video showing officers pulling Karen's car into the garage and walking behind it. It looked routine, but when Alan Jackson replayed the same footage for the jury, he pointed out something almost nobody had noticed. The word police on the cruiser next to Karen's car was backwards. The footage had been flipped. which meant the officers weren't on the left side of the car as it appeared. They were on the right side, the side with the damaged taillight out of view. After this fact was pointed out, the prosecution claimed the camera settings had always recorded that way, but the defense said that the footage was manipulated to hide someone tampering with Karen's car. There was also several minutes of footage missing from the Sallyport where Karen's car had been parked. The Canton Library footage that had captured Karen's car earlier in the night was also missing for the exact window when she would have been returning from 34 Fairview. And John's Ring doorbell footage? That was missing too. Footage that was exclusively accessed through John's phone while it was in Michael Proctor's possession. Three separate sources of footage, all missing at the moments that mattered the most. The first trial lasted 8 weeks. The jury deliberated for 5 days. They came back and said that they couldn't reach a verdict. They asked for clarification on the instructions, but Judge Beverly Cannoni said they already had the instructions and to read them again. The defense also asked if they could change the way that the sheet was written to help the jury understand that each charge was separate, that if they agreed that she was not guilty on one, but was hung on another, they could mark one not guilty and the other one as hung. But the judge denied the request. The jury came back again as hung, and the judge declared a mistrial. But the Commonwealth of Massachusetts wasn't done yet. They announced that they would retry Karen Reed on all counts, and this time, there would be a verdict. At the end of each episode, I like to take a moment to answer any questions you may have about the case and share my thoughts, so make sure to comment below.
Let's talk about the Hoss Long to Die in Cold Search. What's your take?
This is the first detail that pulled me into this case, because the first time I heard about it, I thought, how in the world is a woman on trial if someone inside of the house was Googling how long it takes to die in the cold before the body was even found outside in the cold? Now, the prosecution's explanation about the reused browser tab is technically possible. Phone timestamps can be weird, but even if you accept that explanation, Jen still deleted the search. Why? If you have nothing to hide and you only looked it up because Karen asked you to, why would you go back and delete it? That's the part that doesn't add up for me. And if the defense's expert is right and that search really was made at 2:27 in the morning, then we're looking at something much darker than a witness with bad judgment. We're looking at someone who knew John was outside and was calculating how long he had left. And on top of that, Carrie Roberts initially said she heard Karen ask Jen to search how long it takes for someone to die in the cold that morning. But when the FBI interviewed her in between the first and second trial, her testimony changed, and she said that she never heard Karen ask Jen that. If that isn't extremely suspect, I don't know what is.
The group chat is pretty damning too, especially the "tell them the guy never went into the house" text.
That text is absolutely wild to me. A man you supposedly considered a close friend just died on your front lawn, and you're referring to him as the guy? That's the language of someone managing a PR crisis, not mourning a loss. And the coordination is what really gets me. Not only were they spying on Carrie Roberts' conversation with the police, they became giddy and celebrated when she started telling them everything, aka repeating the narrative they had crafted together before the interview. Matt McCabe is literally predicting whether Karen will fight the charges or take a plea. To me, these are not the texts of innocent bystanders. These are the texts of people who are excited that a certain someone is going to take the fall for John's death. Maybe there's an innocent explanation, but I haven't heard one that makes sense to me yet.
Michael Proctor. Where do we even start with this guy?
If you're ever curious how cops got the nickname pigs, look no further than disgraced state trooper Michael Proctor. Not only was this man saying incredibly inappropriate and disgusting things about his suspect, not only did he rule everyone out and determined Karen was a suspect before even visiting the crime scene, he didn't disclose one of the most blatant conflicts of interest. If it weren't for the actions of Michael Proctor, the frame job would not have been as compelling of a theory as it was. When your lead investigator doesn't treat a single person inside of the house as a potential suspect, doesn't investigate or question their innocence once, and doesn't even attempt to search the house, that is a terrible investigation. But when you find out he knew the people inside of the house all along, that paints an entirely different story. A story of friends covering for friends, cops covering for cops. On the other hand, he is searching the defendant's phone for nude photos, calling her the C-word, making fun of her for her autoimmune diseases, and even goes so far as to text his sister that he hopes Karen kills herself. That's not circumstantial. That's a man who had no business being anywhere near this investigation, and because he was the lead on everything, his bias infected every piece of evidence he touched. You can't separate Proctor from the case. And once the jury understood that, the prosecution's credibility was in serious trouble.
And the evidence handling, I mean, Solo cups and grocery bags, how does that happen?
The way the evidence in this case was handled shows just how inept the Canton Police Department is. I know more about evidence collection than these cops from shows I've watched. You'd think people who have been cops for years would at least know the basics. It's truly insane. This is a case involving the death of a police officer. You'd expect the highest standard of evidence collection. Instead, they're using leaf blowers to clear the snow at the scene, scooping blood into party cups, and storing evidence in unsanitized shopping bags. They didn't photograph John's body before moving it. They didn't secure the scene or have anyone watch over it, which meant it was left unattended for nearly 10 hours. Taillight pieces showed up weeks after the initial search, and multiple sources of surveillance footage just happened to be missing at the exact moments that matter, and the ones they do have were clearly tampered with. It's suspicious to say the least. Maybe all of that is just incompetence. But when you pair it with a lead investigator who had a personal grudge, the fact that potential suspects were cops, and the fact that the lead investigator had personal connections to the people he should have been investigating, incompetence starts to look like something else. Thanks so much for joining me for this episode. Make sure to rate, review, and follow America's Most Infamous Crime so we can keep building this community together. And to get all episodes at once, ad-free, subscribe to Crime House Plus on Apple Podcasts. Come back tomorrow for our final episode on the Karen Reed case. The retrial is about to begin, new evidence is about to surface, and for the first time in 3 years, 12 jurors are going to deliver a verdict. What they decide will either vindicate Karen Reed or send her fight into a whole new chapter. Hi everyone, it's Katie. Before today's episode of America's Most Infamous Crimes, I want to tell you about another show I think you'll love. Crime House and A&E are teaming up on the podcast version of the famous true crime series, The First 48. Each week, Carter Roy takes you inside a landmark homicide case, the interrogations, the dead ends, and the breakthroughs in the critical first 48 hours. Listen to and follow The First 48 every Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.